Wolf Hall, Disc 19.
After supper, he sits talking to Lady Shelton. Lady Bryan has gone to bed, then come down again to chivy them along.
You'll be tired in the morning.
Yes, Anne Shelton agrees, waving her away. In the morning, there'll be no doing anything with us. We'll throw our breakfast on the floor. They sit till the servants yawn off to another room, and the candles burn down, and they retreat into the house, the smaller and warmer rooms, to talk some more. You have given Mary good advice, she says. I hope she heeds it. I fear there are hard times ahead for her. She talks about her brother, Thomas Boleyn, the most selfish man I ever knew. It's no wonder Anne is so grasping. All she has ever heard from him is talk of money and how to gain a mean advantage over people. He would have sold those girls naked at the Barbary slave market if he thought he'd get a good price. He imagines himself surrounded by his scimitared retainers, placing a bid for Mary Boleyn. He smiles and returns his attention to her aunt. She tells him Boleyn's secrets. He tells her no secrets, though she thinks he has. Gregory is asleep when he comes in, but he turns over and says, "Dear father, where have you been? To bed with Lady Shelton?" These things happen, but not with Boleyn's. "What strange dreams you must have. Lady Shelton has been 30 years married."
"I thought I could have sat with Mary after supper," Gregory murmurs. "If I didn't say the wrong thing. But then she is so sneery. I couldn't sit with such a sneery girl."
He flounces over in the feather bed and falls asleep again. When Fisher comes to his senses and asks pardon, the old bishop begs the king to consider that he is ill and infirm. The king indicates that the bill of attainder must take its course, but it is his habit, he says, to grant mercy to those who admit their fault. The maid is to be hanged. He says nothing of the chair of human bones. He tells Henry she has stopped prophesying and hopes that at Tyburn, with the noose around her neck, she will not make a liar out of him. When his counsellors kneel before the king and beg that Thomas More's name be taken out of the bill, Henry yields the point. Perhaps he has been waiting for this, to be persuaded. Anne is not present, or it might have gone otherwise. They get up and go out, dusting themselves. He thinks he hears the cardinal laughing at them from some invisible part of the room. Audley's dignity has not suffered, but the Duke looks agitated. When he tries to get up, elderly knees had failed him, and he and Audley had lifted him by the elbows and set him on his feet. "I thought I might be fixed there another hour," he says, "entreating and entreating him." "The joke is," he says to Audley, "More still being paid a pension from the Treasury. I suppose that had better stop."
"He has a breathing space now. I pray to God he'll see sense. Has he arranged his affairs?"
"Made over what he can to the children, so Roper tells me."
"Oh, you liars," the Duke says. "On the day I go down, who will look after me?"
Norfolk is sweating. He eases his pace and Audley checks too, so they are dawdling along, and Cranmer comes behind like an afterthought. He turns back and takes his arm. He has been at every sitting of Parliament, the bench of bishops otherwise conspicuously underpopulated. The Pope chooses this month, while he is rolling his great bills through Parliament, to give his judgment at last on Queen Catherine's marriage, a judgment so long delayed that he thought Clement meant to die in his indecision. The original dispensations, Clement finds, are sound. Therefore the marriage is sound. The supporters of the Emperor let off fireworks in the streets of Rome. Henry is contemptuous, sardonic. He expresses these feelings by dancing. Anne can dance still, though her belly shows. She must take the summer quietly. He remembers the king's hand on Lizzie Seymour's waist. Nothing came of that. The young woman is no fool. Now it is little Mary Shelton he is whirling around, lifting her off her feet and tickling her and squeezing her and making her breathless with compliments. These things mean nothing. He sees Anne lift up her chin and avert her gaze and lean back in her chair, making some murmured comment, her expression arch. Her veil brushing for the briefest moment against the jacket of that grinning cur, Francis Weston. It is clear Anne thinks Mary Shelton must be tolerated, kept sweet even. It's safest to keep the king among cousins, if no sister is on hand. Where is Mary Boleyn? Down in the country, perhaps longing like him for warmer weather. And the summer arrives, with no intermission for spring, promptly on a Monday morning, like a new servant with a shining face. 13th of April. There at Lambeth, Audley, himself, the Archbishop, the sun shining strongly through the windows. He stands looking down at the palace gardens. This is how the book Utopia begins. Friends talking in a garden. On the path below, Hugh Latimer and some of the king's chaplains are play-fighting, pulling each other around like schoolboys. Hugh hanging around the necks of two of his clerical fellows so his feet swing off the floor. All they need is a football to make a proper holiday of it. "Master Moore," he says, "why don't you go out and enjoy the sunshine? And we'll call for you again in half an hour, and put the oath to you again. And you'll give us a different answer, yes?" He hears Moore's joints snap as he stands. "Thomas Howard went on his knees for you," he says. That seems like weeks ago. Late-night sittings and a fresh row every day have tired him, but sharpened his senses too. So he is aware that in the room behind him, Cranmer is working himself into a terrible anxiety, and he wants Moore out of the room before the dam breaks. "I don't know what you think a half hour will do for me," Moore says. His tone is easy, bantering. "Of course it might do something for you." Moore had asked to see a copy of the Act of Succession. Now Audley unrolls it. Pointedly, he bends his head and begins reading, though he has read it a dozen times. "Very well," Moore says, "but I trust I have made myself clear. I cannot swear, but I will not speak against your oath, and I will not try to dissuade anyone else from it." "That is not enough, and you know it is not." Moore nods. He meanders towards the door, careering first into the corner of the table, making Cranmer flinch, his arm darting out to steady the ink. The door closes after him. "So." Audley rolls up the statute. Gently he taps it on the table, looking at the place where Moore had stood. Cranmer says,
"Look, this is my idea. What if we let him swear in secret? He swears, but we offer not to tell anybody. Or if he cannot take this oath, we ask him what oath he can take."
He laughs.
"That would hardly meet the king's purpose."
Audley sighs. Tap, tap, tap.
"After all we did for him and for Fisher, his name taken out of the attainder, Fisher fined instead of locked up for life, what more could they ask for? Our efforts flung back at us."
"Oh, well, blessed are the peacemakers," he says. "He wants to strangle somebody."
Cranmer says, "We will try again with Moore. At least, if he refuses, he should give his reasons."
He swears under his breath, turns from the window.
"We know his reasons. All Europe knows them. He is against the divorce. He does not believe the king can be head of the church. But will he say that? Not he. I know him. Do you know what I hate? I hate to be part of this play, which is entirely devised by him. I hate the time it will take that could be better spent. I hate it that minds could be better employed. I hate to see our lives going by, because, depend upon it, we will all be feeling our age before this pageant is played out. And what I hate most of all is that Master Moore sits in the audience and sniggers when I trip over my lines, for he has written all the parts, and written them these many years." Cranmer, like a waiting boy, pours him a cup of wine, edges towards him.
"Here."
In the Archbishop's hand, the cup cannot help a sacramental character. Not watered wine, but some equivocal mixture. This is my blood. This is like my blood. This is more or less somewhat like my blood. Do this in commemoration of me. He hands the cup back. The North Germans make a strong liquor, aquavitae. A shot of that would be more use. Get more back, he says. A moment and Moore stands in the doorway, sneezing gently.
Come now, Audley says, smiling. That's not how a hero arrives.
I assure you I intend in no wise to be a hero, Moore says. They have been cutting the grass. He pinches his nose on another sneeze and shambles towards them, hitching his gown onto his shoulder. He takes the chair placed for him. Before, he had refused to sit down.
That's better, Audley says. I knew the air would do you good.
He glances up in invitation, but he, Cromwell, signals he will stay where he is, leaning by the window.
I don't know, Audley says, good-humoured. First one won't sit, then t'other won't sit. Look.
He pushes a piece of paper towards Moore.
These are the names of the priests we've seen today, who have sworn to the act and set you an example. And you know all the members of Parliament are conformable, so why not you?
Moore glances up from under his eyebrows.
This is not a comfortable place for any of us.
More comfortable than where you're going, he says.
Not hell, Moore says, smiling. I trust not.
So, if taking the oath would damn you, what about all these? He launches himself forward from the wall. He snatches the list of names from Audley, rolls it up and slaps it onto Moore's shoulder. Are they all damned?
I cannot speak for their consciences, only for my own. I know that if I took your oath, I should be damned.
There are those who would envy your insight into the workings of grace. But then, you and God have always been on familiar terms, not so? I wonder how you dare. You talk about your Maker as if he was some neighbour you went fishing with on a Sunday afternoon. Audley leans forward.
Let us be clear. You will not take the oath because your conscience advises you against it?
Yes.
Could you be a little more comprehensive in your answers?
No.
You object, but you won't say why?
Yes.
Is it the matter of the statute you object to, or the form of the oath, or the business of oath-taking in itself?
I would rather not say.
Cranmer ventures.
Where it is a question of conscience, there must always be some doubt.
Oh, but this is no whim. I have made long and diligent consultation with myself, and in this matter I hear the voice of my conscience clearly.
He puts his head on one side, smiling.
It is not so with you, my lord.
Nonetheless, there must be some perplexity, for you must ask yourself, as you are a scholar and accustomed to controversy, to debate, how can so many learned men think on the one side and I on the other? But one thing is certain. It is that you owe a natural obedience to your king, as every subject does. Also, when you entered the king's council long ago, you took a most particular oath to obey him. So, will you not do so?
Cranmer blinks.
Set your doubts against that certainty and swear.
Audley sits back in his chair, eyes closed, as if to say, we're not going to do better than that. Moore says,
when you were consecrated archbishop appointed by the Pope, you swore your oath to Rome. But all day in your fist, they say, all through the ceremonies you kept a little paper folded up, saying that you took the oath under protest. Is that not true? They say the paper was written by Master Cromwell here.
Audley's eyes snap open. He thinks Moore has shown himself the way out. But Moore's face, smiling, is a mask of malice.
I would not be such a juggler, he says softly. I would not treat the Lord my God to such a puppet show, let alone the faithful of England. You say you have the majority, I say I have it. You say Parliament is behind you, and I say all the angels and saints are behind me,
and all the company of the Christian dead, for as many generations as there have been since the Church of Christ was founded, one body, undivided.
Oh, for Christ's sake, he says.
A lie is no less a lie because it is 1,000 years old. Your undivided church has liked nothing better than persecuting its own members, burning them, and hacking them apart when they stood by their own conscience, slashing their bellies open and feeding their guts to dogs. You call history to your aid, but what is history to you? It is a mirror that flatters Thomas More. But I have another mirror. I hold it up, and it shows a vain and dangerous man. And when I turn it about, it shows a killer. For you will drag down with you God knows how many, who will only have the suffering and not your martyr's gratification. You are not a simple soul, so don't try to make this simple. You know I have respected you. You know I have respected you since I was a child. I would rather see my only son dead. I would rather see them cut off his head than see you refuse this oath and give comfort to every enemy of England. More looks up. For a fraction of a second he meets his gaze, then turns away, coy. His low, amused murmur. He could kill him for that alone. Gregory is a goodly young man. Don't wish him away. If he has done badly, he will do better. I say the same of my own boy. What's the use of him? But he is worth more than a debating point. Cranmer, distressed, shakes his head.
This is no debating point.
You speak of your son, he says. What will happen to him, to your daughters? I shall advise them to take the oath. I do not suppose them to share my scruples.
That is not what I mean, and you know it. It is the next generation you are betraying. You want the Emperor's foot on their neck? You are no Englishman.
You are barely that yourself, Moore says. Fight for the French, eh? Bank for the Italians. You were scarcely grown up in this realm before your boyhood transgressions drove you out of it. You ran away to escape jail or a noose. No, I tell you what you are, Cromwell. You are an Italian through and through, and you have all their vices, all their passions. He sits back in his chair, one mirthless grunt of laughter. This relentless bonhomie of yours, I knew it would wear out in the end. It is a coin that has changed hands so often. And now the small silver is worn out and we see the base metal.
Audley smirks.
You seem not to have noted Master Cromwell's efforts at the mint. His coinage is sound, or it is nothing.
The Chancellor cannot help it, that he is a smirking sort of man. Someone must keep calm. Cranmer is pale and sweating, and he can see the pulse galloping at Moore's temple. He says,
"We cannot let you go home. Still, it seems to me that you are not yourself today. So rather than commit you to the Tower, we could perhaps place you in the custody of the Abbot of Westminster. Would that seem suitable to you, my Lord of Canterbury?"
Cranmer nods.
Moore says, "Master Cromwell, I should not mock you, should I? You have shown yourself my most especial and tender friend."
Audley nods to the guard at the door. Moore rises smoothly, as if the thought of custody has put a spring in his step. The effect is spoiled only by his usual grab at his garments, the scuffle as he shrugs himself together, and even then he seems to step backwards and tread on his own feet. He thinks of Mary at Hatfield, rising from her stool and forgetting where she'd left it. After some fashion, Moore is bundled out of the room.
"Now, he's got exactly what he wants," he says.
He puts his palm against the glass of the window. He sees the smudge it makes against the old floored glass. A bank of cloud has come up over the river. The best of the day is behind them. Audley crosses the room to him. Hesitant, he stands at his shoulder.
If only Moore would indicate which part of the oath he finds objectionable. It is possible something might be written to meet his objection.
You can forget that. If he indicates anything, he is done for. Silence is his only hope.
and it's not much of a hope at that.
The king might accept some compromise, Cranmer says.
But I fear the queen will not. And indeed, he says faintly, why should she?
Audley puts a hand on his arm.
My dear Cromwell, who can understand more? His friend Erasmus told him to keep away from government. He told him he had not the stomach for it, and he was right. He should never have accepted the office I now hold. He only did it to spite Wolsey, whom he hated.
Cranmer says,
he told him to keep away from theology too, unless I am wrong.
How could you be?
Moore publishes all his letters from his friends. Even when they reprove him, he makes a fine show of his humility and so turns it to his profit. He has lived in public. Every thought that passes through his mind he has committed to paper. He never kept anything private till now.
Audley reaches past him, opens the window. A torrent of birdsong crests on the edge of the sill and spills into the room, the liquid, fluent notes of the storm thrush.
I suppose he's writing an account of today, he says, and sending it out of the kingdom to be printed. Depend upon it, in the eyes of Europe we will be the fools and the oppressors, and he will be the poor victim with a better turn of phrase.
Audley pats his arm. He wants to console him, but who can begin to do it? He is the inconsolable Master Cromwell, the unknowable, the inconstruable, the probably indefeasible Master Cromwell.
Next day, the king sends for him. He supposes it is to berate him for failing to get Moore to take the oath.
Who will accompany me to this fiesta? He inquires. Master Sadler?
As soon as he enters the king's presence, Henry gestures with a peremptory sweep of his arm for his attendants to clear a space and leave him alone in it. His face is like thunder.
Cromwell, have I not been a good lord to you?
He begins to talk, gracious and more than gracious. Own sad unworthiness, if fallen short in any particular, begs most gracious pardon. He can do this all day. He learned it from Wolsey.
Henry says, because my lord archbishop thinks I have not done well by you. But, he says in the tone of one misunderstood, I am a prince known for my munificence.
The whole thing seems to puzzle him.
You are to be master secretary. Rewards shall follow. I do not understand why I have not done this long ago, but tell me. When it was put to you about the Lords Cromwell that once were in England, you said you were nothing to them. Have you thought further?
To be honest, I never gave it another thought. I wouldn't wear another man's coat or bear his arms. He might rise up from his grave and take issue with me.
My Lord Norfolk says you enjoy being low-born. He says you have devised it so to torment him.
Henry takes his arm.
It would seem convenient to me, he says, that wherever we go, though we shall not go far this summer, considering the Queen's condition, you should have rooms provided for you next to mine, so we can speak whenever I need you, and where it is possible, rooms that communicate directly, so that I need no go-between.
He smiles toward the courtiers. They wash back, like a tide.
God strike me, Henry says, if I meant to neglect you. I know when I have a friend.
Outside, Ralph says, God strike him! What terrible oaths he swears! He hugs his master.
This has been too long in coming. But listen, I have something to tell you when we get home.
Tell me now. Is it something good?
A gentleman comes forward and says, Master Secretary, your barge is waiting to take you back to the city.
I should have a house on the river, he says, like Moore.
Oh, but leave Austin Friars. Think of the tennis court, Ralph says. The gardens.
The king has made his preparations in secret.
Gardener's arms have been burned off the paintwork. A flag with his coat of arms is raised beside the Tudor flag. He steps into his barge for the first time, and on the river, Ralph tells his news. The rocking of the boat beneath them is imperceptible. The flags are limp. It is a still morning, misty and dappled, and where the light touches flesh or linen or fresh leaves, There was a sheen like the sheen on an eggshell. The whole world luminous, its angle softened, its scent watery and green. "I have been married half a year," Rafe says. "And no one knows, but you know now. I have married Helen Barr."
"Oh, blood of Christ," he says. "Beneath my own roof. What did you do that for?"
Rafe sits mute while he says it all. "She's a lovely nobody. A poor woman with no advantage to bring to you. You could have married an heiress. Wait till you tell your father. He will be outraged. He will say I have not looked after your interests.
And suppose one day her husband turns up?"
"You told her she was free," Rafe says. He is trembling.
"Which of us is free?"
He remembers what Helen had said. "So I could marry again, if anybody wanted me." He remembers how she had looked at him, a long look and full of meaning, only he did not read it. She might as well have turned somersaults. He would not have noticed. His mind had moved elsewhere. That conversation was over for him, and he was on to something else. If I had wanted her for myself and taken her, who could have reproached me for marrying a penniless laundress, even a beggar off the street? People would have said, "So that was what Cromwell wanted, a beauty with supple flesh. No wonder he disdained the widows of the city. He doesn't need money. He doesn't need connections. He can afford to follow his appetites. He is master secretary now, and what next?" He stares down into the water, now brown, now clear as the light catches it, but always moving. The fish in its depths, the weeds, the drowned men with bony hands swimming. On the mud and shingle there are cast-up belt buckles, fragments of glass, small warped coins with the king's faces washed away. Once when he was a boy he found a horseshoe, a horse in the river. It seemed to him a very lucky find. But his father said, "If horseshoes were lucky, boy, I would be the king of cocaine." First he goes out to the kitchens to tell Thurston the news.
"Well," the cook says easily, "as you're doing the job anyway."
A chuckle.
"Bishop Gardiner will be burning up inside. His giblets will be sizzling in his own grease."
He whisks a blooded cloth from a tray.
"See these quails? You get more meat on a wasp."
"Malmsey," he suggests.
"Seethe them." "What, 3 dozen? Waste of good wine. I'll do some for you if you like. Come from Lord Lyle at Calais. When you write, tell him if he sends another batch, we want them fatter or not at all. Will you remember?"
"I'll make a note," he says gravely. "From now on, I thought we might have the council meet here sometimes when the king isn't sitting with us. We can give them dinner before."
"Right," Thurston titters. "Norfolk could do with some flesh on his twiggy little legs."
"Thurston, you needn't dirty your hands. You have enough staff. You could put on a gold chain and strut about."
"Is that what you'll be doing?"
A wet poultry slap. Then Thurston looks up at him, wiping pluck from his fingers.
"I think I'd rather keep my end in case things take a downturn. Not that I say they will. Remember the Cardinal, though."
He remembers Norfolk.
"Tell him to go north, or I will come where he is and tear him with my teeth."
"May I substitute the word bite?" The saying comes to him. Homo homini lupus. Man is wolf to man. "So," he says to Rafe after supper, "you've made your name, Master Saddler. You'll be held up as a prime example of how to waste your connections. Fathers will point you out to their sons."
"I couldn't help it, sir."
"How not help it?" Rafe says, as dry as he can manage.
"I am violently in love with her."
"How does that feel? Is it like being violently angry?"
"I suppose. Maybe. In that you feel more alive."
"I do not think I could feel any more alive than I am."
He wonders if the Cardinal was ever in love. But of course, why did he doubt? The all-consuming passion of Wolsey for Wolsey was hot enough to scorch all England. "Tell me, that evening after the Queen was crowned..." He shakes his head, turns over some papers on his desk. Letters from the Mayor of Hull.
"I will tell you anything you ask," Rafe says. "I cannot imagine how I was not frank with you. But Helen, my wife, she thought it was better to be secret."
"But now she is carrying a child, I suppose. So you must declare yourselves." Rafe blushes. "That evening, when I came into Austin Friars looking for her, to take her to Cranmer's wife, and she came down..." His eyes move as if he were seeing it. "She came down without her cap, and you after her, with your hair sticking up, and you were angry with me for taking her away."
"Well, yes," Rafe says. His hand creeps up and he flattens his hair with his palm, as if that would help matters now. "They were all gone out to the feasts. That was the first time I took her to bed. But it was no blame. By then she had promised herself to me."
He thinks, "I am glad I have not brought up in my house a young man without feeling, who only studies his advancement. If you are without impulses, you are, to a degree, without joy. Under my protection, impulses are a thing Rafe can afford." "Look, Rafe, this is a, well, God knows, a folly, but not a disaster. Tell your father my promotion in the world will ensure yours. Of course he will stamp and roar. It is what fathers are for. He will shout, 'I rue the day I parted with my boy to the debauched house of Cromwell.' But we will bring him around, a little and a little." Till now the boy has been standing. He subsides onto a stool, hands on his head, head flung back. Relief washes through his whole body. Was he so afraid of me? "Look, when your father sets eyes on Helen, he'll understand unless he's..." "Unless he's what?" "You'd have to be dead and entombed not to notice. Her bold and beautiful body, her mild eyes. We just need to get her out of that canvas apron she goes around in and dress her up as Mistress Sadler. And of course you will want a house of your own. I will help you there. I shall miss the little children. I've grown fond of them. And Mercy, too. We're all fond of them. If you want this new one to be the first child in your house, we can keep them here." "It is good of you, but Helen would never part with them. It is understood between us." "So, I shall never have any more children at Austin Friars," he thinks. "Well, not unless I take time out of the king's business and go wooing. Not unless, when a woman speaks to me, I actually listen. What will reconcile your father, and you can tell him this, is that from now on, when I am not with the king, you will be with him. Master Risley will tease the diplomats and keep the ciphers, for it is sly work which will suit him. And Richard will be here to head the household when I am absent and drive my work forward. And you and I will attend on Henry as sweet as two nursemaids and cater to his whims." He laughs. "You are a gentleman born. He may promote you close to his person, to the privy chamber, which would be useful to me. I did not look for this to happen. I did not plan it." Rafe drops his eyes. "I know I can never take Helen with me to court. Not as the world is now. And I do not think it will change in our lifetimes. But look, you have made your choice. You must never repent it." Rafe says, passionate, "How could I think to keep a secret from you? You see everything, sir."
"Ah, only up to a point."
When Rafe has gone, he takes out his evening's work and begins on it, methodical, tapping the papers into place. His bills are passed, but there is always another bill. When you are writing laws, you are testing words to find their utmost power. Like spells, they have to make things happen in the real world, and like spells, they only work if people believe in them. If your law exacts a penalty, you must be able to enforce it. On the rich as well as the poor, the people on the Scottish borders and the Welsh marches, the men of Cornwall as well as the men of Sussex and Kent. He has written this oath, a test of loyalty to Henry, and he means to swear the men of every burg and village, and all women of any consequence, widows with inheritances, landowners, His people will be tramping the Wold and Heathland, pledging those who have barely heard of Anne Boleyn to uphold the succession of the child in her womb. If a man knows the king is called Henry, swear him. Never mind if he confuses this king with his father or some Henry who came before. For princes, like other men, fade from the memory of common people. Their features, on those coins he used to sift from the river silt, were no more than a slight irregularity under his fingertips. And even when he had taken the coins home and scrubbed them, he could not say who they might be. Is this, he asked, Prince Caesar? Walter had said, let's see. Then he had flipped the coin away from him in disgust, saying, it's but a tinny farthing from one of those kings who fought the French wars. Get out there and earn, he'd said. Never mind Prince Caesar. Caesar was old when Adam was a lad. He would chant, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? Walter would chase him and hit him if he could catch him. There's a bloody rebel song for you. We know what to do with rebels here. They are dug into shallow graves. The Cornishman who came up the country when he was a boy. But there are always more Cornishmen. And beneath Cornwall, beyond and beneath this whole realm of England, beneath the sodden marches of Wales and the rough territory of the Scots border, there is another landscape. There is a buried empire, where he fears his commissioners cannot reach. Who will swear the hobs and boggarts who live in the hedges and in hollow trees, and the wild men who hide in the woods? Who will swear the saints in their niches, and the spirits that cluster at holy wells, rusting like fallen leaves, and the miscarried infants dug into unconsecrated ground? All those unseen dead who hover in winter around forges and village hearths, trying to warm their bare bones. For they too are his countrymen, the generations of the uncounted dead, breathing through the living, stealing their light from them, the bloodless ghosts of lord and knave, nun and whore, the ghosts of priests and friar who feed on living England and suck the substance from the future. He stares down at the papers on his desk, but his thoughts are far from here. My daughter Anne said, I choose Rafe. He lowers his head into his hands and closes his eyes. Anne Cromwell stands before him, 10 or 11 years old, broad and resolute like a man-at-arms, her small eyes unblinking, sure of her power to make her fate. He rubs his eyes, sifts his papers. What is this? A list? A meticulous clerk's hand, legible but making scant sense. 2 carpets, 1 cut in pieces, 7 sheets, 2 pillows, 1 bolster, 2 platters, 4 dishes, 2 saucers, 1 small basin, weight 12 pounds at 4 pence the pound. My lady prioress has it, paid 4 shillings. He turns the paper over, trying to find its origin. He sees that he is looking at the inventory of Elizabeth Barton's goods, left behind at her nunnery. All this is forfeit to the king, the personal property of a traitor, a piece of plank which serves as a table, 3 pillowcases, 2 candlesticks, a coat valued at 5 shillings. An old mantle has been given in charity to the youngest nun in her convent. Another nun, a Dame Alice, has received a bed cover. He had said to Moore, prophecy didn't make her rich. He makes a memorandum to himself. Dame Elizabeth Barton to have money to fee the hangman. She has 5 days to live. The last person she will see as she climbs the ladder is her executioner, holding out his paw. If she cannot pay her way at the last, she may suffer longer than she needs. She had imagined how long it takes to burn, but not how long it takes to choke at the end of a rope. In England there is no mercy for the poor. You pay for everything, even a broken neck. Thomas More's family has taken the oath. He has seen them himself, and Alice has left him in no doubt that she holds him personally responsible for failing to talk her husband into conformity. Ask him what in the name of God he's about. Ask him, is it clever, does he think it is, to leave his wife without company, his son without advice, his daughters without protection, and all of us at the mercy of a man like Thomas Cromwell? "That's you told," Meg had murmured with half a smile. Head bowed, she'd taken his hand between her own. "My father has spoken very warmly of you, of how you have been courteous to him, and how you have been vehement, which he accounts no less a favour. He says he believes you understand him, as he understands you."
"Meg, surely you can look at me."
Another face bowed under the weight of a gable hood. Meg twitches her veils about her, as if she were out in a gale and they would provide protection.
"I can hold the king off for a day or two. I don't believe he wishes to see your father in the tower. Every moment he looks for some sign of
surrender,
support. And then, no honour would be too high."
"I doubt the king can offer the sort of honour he cares for," Will Roper says, "unfortunately. Come on, Meg, let's go home. We need to get your mother on the river before she starts a brawl."
Roper holds out his hand. "We know you are not vengeful, sir, though God knows he's never been a friend to your friends. There was a time you were a Bible man yourself.
Men may change opinions."
"I agree entirely. Tell your father-in-law that." It was a sour note to part on. "I shall not indulge more," he thinks, "or his family, in any illusion that they understand me. How could that be, when my workings are hidden from myself?" He makes a note. "Richard Cromwell to present himself to the Abbot of Westminster to escort Sir Thomas More prisoner to the tower."
"Why do I hesitate? Let's give him one more day." It is the 15th of April, 1534. He calls in a clerk to tidy and file his papers ready for tomorrow and lingers by the fire chatting. It is midnight and the candles are burned down. He takes one and goes upstairs. Christoph, snoring, sprawls across the foot of his wide and lonely bed. "Dear God," he thinks, "my life is ridiculous."
"Wake up," he says, but in a whisper. When Christoph does not respond, he lays hands on him and rolls him up and down, as if he were the lid for a pie, till the boy wakes up, expostulating in gutter French.
"Oh, by the hairy balls of Jesus," he blinks violently. "My good master, I did not know it was you. I was dreaming I was a pastry. Forgive me, I am completely drunk. We have been celebrating the conjunction of the beautiful Helen with the fortunate Ralph."
He raises a forearm, curls up his fist, makes a gesture of the utmost lewdness. His arm falls limp across his body. His eyelids slide ineluctably towards his cheeks, and with a final hiccup, he subsides into sleep. He hauls the boy to his pallet. Christoph is heavy now, a rotund bulldog pup. He grunts, he mutters, but he does not wake again. He lays aside his clothes and says his prayers. He puts his head on the pillow. 7 sheets, 2 pillows, 1 bolster. He sleeps as soon as the candle is out. But his daughter, Anne, comes to him in a dream. She holds up her left hand, sorrowful, to show him she wears no wedding ring. She twists up her long hair and wraps it around her neck like a noose. Midsummer. Women hurry to the Queen's apartments with clean linen folded over their arms. Their faces are blank and shocked, and they walk so quickly you know not to stop them. Fires are lit within the Queen's apartments to burn what has bled away. If there is anything to bury, the women keep it a secret between themselves. That night, huddled in a window embrasure, the sky lit by stars like daggers, Henry will tell him it is Catherine I blame. I believe she ill-wishes me. The truth is, her womb is diseased. All those years she deceived me. She couldn't carry a son, and she and her doctors knew it. She claims she still loves me, but she is destroying me. She comes in the night with her cold hands and her cold heart and lies between me and the woman I love. She puts her hand on my member, and her hand smells of the tomb. The lords and ladies give the maids and midwives money to say what sex the child was, but the women give different answers each time. Indeed, what would be worse? for Anne to have conceived another girl, or to have conceived and miscarried a boy. Midsummer. Bonfires are lit all over London, burning through the short nights. Dragons stalk the streets, puffing out smoke and clattering their mechanical wings. Chapter 2. The Map of Christendom, 1534 to 1535.
"Do you want Audley's post?" Henry asks him.
"It's yours if you say so." The summer is over. The Emperor has not come. Pope Clement is dead, and his judgment's with him. The game is to play again, and he has left the door open, just a chink, for the next Bishop of Rome to hold the conversation with England. Personally, he would slam it shut, but these are not personal matters. Now he thinks carefully. Would it suit him to be Chancellor? It would be good to have a post in the legal hierarchy, so why not at the top? "I have no wish to disturb Audley. If your Majesty is satisfied with him, I am too." He remembers how the post tied Wolsey to London when the King was elsewhere. The Cardinal was active in the law courts, but we have lawyers enough. Henry says, "Only tell me what you deem best." Abased like a lover, he cannot think of the best presents. He says, "Cranmer bids me listen to Cromwell, and if he needs a post, a tax, an impost, a measure in Parliament or a royal proclamation, give it to him." The post of Master of the Rolls is vacant. It is an ancient judicial office. It commands one of the kingdom's great secretariats. His predecessors will be those men, bishops for the most part, eminent in learning, those who lie down on their tombs with their virtues in Latin engraved beneath. He is never more alive than when he twists the stem of this ripe fruit and snaps it from the tree. "You were also right about Cardinal Farnese," Henry says. "Now we have a new pope, Bishop of Rome, I should say. I have collected on my bets." "You see," he says, smiling, "Cranmer is right. Be advised by me." The court is amused to hear how the Romans have celebrated Pope Clement's death. They have broken into his tomb and dragged his naked body through the streets. The master's house in Chancery Lane is the most curious house he has ever entered. It smells of must, mould, and tallow, and behind its crooked facade it meanders back, a warren of little spaces with low doorways. Were our forebears all dwarves, or were they not perfectly certain how to prop up a ceiling? This house was founded 300 years ago by the Henry that was then. He built it as a refuge for Jews who wished to convert. If they took this step, advisable if they wished to be preserved from violence, they would forfeit all their possessions to the crown. This being so, it was just that the crown should house and feed them for their natural lives. Christoph runs ahead of him into the depths of the house. "Look!" He trails his finger through a vast spider's web. "You've broken up her home, you heartless boy." He examines Ariane's crumbling prey, a leg, a wing. "Let's be gone before she comes back." Some 50 years after Henry had endowed the house, all Jews were expelled from the realm. Yet the refuge was never quite empty. Even today, two women lived here. "I shall call on them," he says. Christoph is tapping the walls and beams, for all the world as if he knew what he was looking for. "Wouldn't you run," he says with relish, "if someone tapped back?"
"Oh, Jesus," Christoph crosses himself. "I expect 100 men have died here, Jews and Christians both."
Behind this wainscot, it is true he can sense the tiny bones of mice. 100 generations. Their articulated forefeet folded in eternal rest. Their descendants, thriving, he can smell in the air. "This is a job for Marlinspike," he says, if we can catch him. The Cardinal's cat is feral now, ranging at will through London gardens, lured by the scent of carp from the ponds of city monasteries, tempted, for all he knows, across the river, to be snuggled to the bosoms of whores, slack breasts rubbed with rose petals and ambergris. He imagines Marlinspike lolling, purring, declining to come home again. He says to Christoph, I wonder how I can be master of the rolls if I'm not master of a cat.
The rolls have not paused to go walking.
Christoph is kicking a skirting.
My foot go through it, he says, demonstrating.
Will he leave the comforts of Austin Friars for the tiny windows with their warped panes, the creaking passages, the ancient draughts? It'll be a shorter journey to Westminster, he says. His aim is bent there. Whitehall, Westminster, and the river. Master Secretary's barge down to Greenwich or up to Hampton Court. I shall be back at Austin Friars often, he says to himself, almost every day. He's building a treasure room, a repository secure for any gold plate the king entrusts to him. Whatever he deposits can quickly be turned into ready money. His treasure comes through the street on ordinary carts to attract no attention, though there are vigilant outriders. The chalices are fitted into soft leather cases made for them. The bowls and dishes travel in canvas bags, interleaved with white woolen cloth at 7 pence the yard. The jewels are swaddled in silk and packed into chests with new and shiny locks, and he has the keys. There are great pearls which gleam wet from the ocean, sapphires hot as India. There are jewels like the fruit you pick on a country afternoon, garnets like sloes, pink diamonds like rose hips. Alice says, for a handful of these I would myself overthrow any queen in Christendom. What a good thing the king hasn't met you, Alice. Joe says, I would as soon have it in export licenses or army contracts. Someone will make a fortune in the Irish wars. Beans, flour, malt, horse flesh. I shall see what I can do for you, he says. At Austin Friars he holds the lease for 99 years. His great-grandchildren will have it, some unknown Londoners. When they look at the documents, his name will be there. His arms will be carved over the doorways. He rests his hand on the banister of the great staircase, looks up into the dust-mote glitter from a high window. When did I do this? At Hatfield, early in the year, looking up, listening for the sounds of Morton's household long ago. If he himself went to Hatfield, must not Thomas More have gone up too? Perhaps it was his light footstep he expected overhead. He starts to think again about that fist that came out of nowhere. His first idea had been move clerks and papers to the rolls, then Austin Friars would become a home again. But for whom? He has taken out Liz's book of hours, and on the page where she kept the family listed, he has made alterations, additions. Rafe will be moving out soon to his new house in Hackney, and Richard is building in the same neighbourhood with his wife, Frances. Alice is marrying his ward, Thomas Rotherham. Her brother, Christopher, is ordained and beneficed. Joe's wedding clothes are ordered. She's snapped up by his friend John Ap Rice, a lawyer, a scholar, a man he admires and on whose loyalty he counts. I have done well for my folk, he thinks, not one of them poor or unhappy or uncertain of their place in this uncertain world. He hesitates, looking up into the light. Now gold, now blue as a cloud passes. Whoever will come downstairs and claim him must do it now. His daughter Anne, with her thundering feet. Anne, he would say to her, couldn't we have felt mufflers over those hooves of yours? Grace, skimming down like dust, drawn into a spiral, a lively swirl, going nowhere, dispersing, gone. Liz, come down. But Liz keeps her silence. She neither stays nor goes. She is always with him and not with him. He turns away. So this house will become a place of business, as all his houses will become places of business. My home will be where my clerks and files are. Otherwise, my home will be with the king, where he is. Christoph says,
Now we are removed to the Rolls house, I can tell you, cher maître, how I am happy that you did not leave me behind, for in your absence they would call me snail-brain and turniped.
Alors, he takes a view of Christoph, your head is indeed like a turnip. Thank you for attracting my attention to it. Installed at the Rolls, He takes a view of his situation. Satisfactory. He has sold off his 2 Kent manors, but the king has given him 1 in Monmouthshire, and he's buying another in Essex. He has his eye on plots in Hackney and Shoreditch, and is taking in leases on the properties around Austin Friars, which he intends to enfold in his building plans, and then build a big wall around the lot. He has surveys to hand of a manor in Bedfordshire, 1 in Lincolnshire, and 2 Essex properties he intends to put in trust for Gregory. All this is small stuff. It's nothing to what he intends to have, or to what Henry will owe him. Meanwhile, his outgoings would frighten a lesser man. If the king wants something done, you have to be able to staff the enterprise and fund it. It is hard to keep up with the spending of his noble councillors, and yet there are a crew of them who live at the pawn shop and come to him month by month to patch the holes in their accounts. He knows when to let these debts run. There is more than one kind of currency in England. What he senses is a great net is spreading about him, a web of favours done and favours received. Those who want access to the king expect to pay for it, and no one has better access than he. And at the same time, the word is out. Help Cromwell, and he will help you. Be loyal, be diligent, be intelligent on his behalf. You will come into a reward. Those who commit their service to him will be promoted and protected. He is a good friend and master. This is said of him everywhere. Otherwise, it is the usual abuse. His father was a blacksmith, a crooked brewer. He was an Irishman. He was a criminal. He was a Jew. And he himself was just a wool trader. He was a shearsman, and now he is a sorcerer. How else but by being a sorcerer would he get the reins of power in his hand? Chapuis writes to the Emperor about him. His early life remains a mystery, but he is excellent company, and he keeps his household and retainers in magnificent style. He is a master of language, Chapuis writes, a man of most eloquent address, though his French, he adds, is only assez bien. He thinks it's good enough for you. A nod and a wink will do for you. These last months, the council has never been out of harness. A hard summer of negotiating has brought a treaty with the Scots, but Ireland is in revolt. Only Dublin Castle itself and the town of Waterford hold out for the king, while the rebel lords are offering their services and their harbours to the Emperor's troops. Among these isles, it is the most wretched of territories, which does not pay the king what it costs him to garrison it. But he cannot turn his back on it, for fear of who else might come in. Law is barely respected there, for the Irish think you can buy off murder with money, and like the Welsh, they cost out a man's life in cattle. The people are kept poor by imposts and seizures, by forfeitures and plain daylight robbery. The pious English abstain from meat on Wednesdays and Fridays, but the joke runs that the Irish are so godly, they abstain every other day as well. Their great lords are brutal and imperious men, treacherous and fickle, inveterate feuders, extortionists and hostage-takers. And their allegiance to England they hold cheap, for they are loyal to nothing and prefer force of arms to law. As for the native chiefs, they recognise no natural limit to their claims. They say that on their land they own every ferny slope and lake, they own the heather, the meadow grass, and the winds that riffle it. They own every beast and every man, and in times of scarcity they take the bread to feed their hunting dogs. No wonder they don't want to be English. It would interrupt their status as slave owners. The Duke of Norfolk still has serfs on his land, and even if the law courts move to free them, the Duke expects a fee from it. The king proposes to send Norfolk to Ireland, but he says he's spent enough futile months over there, and the only way he'll go back is if they build a bridge so he can get home at the end of the week without getting his feet wet. He and Norfolk fight in the council chamber. The Duke rants, and he sits back and folds his arms and watches him ranting. "You should have sent young Fitzroy to Dublin," he tells the council. "An apprentice king. Make a show, stage a spectacle, throw some money about." Richard says to him, "Perhaps we should go to Ireland, sir." "I think my campaigning days are over. I would like to be in arms. Every man should be a soldier once in his life.
That is your grandfather speaking through you. Ap Evans, the archer. Concentrate for now on making a show in the tournaments.
Richard has proved a formidable man in the lists. It is more or less, as Christoph says, biff, and they are flat. You would think the sport was in his nephew's blood, as it is in the blood of the lords who compete. He carries the Cromwell colours, and the king loves him for it, as he loves any man with flair and courage and physical strength. Increasingly, his bad leg forces him to sit with the spectators. When he is in pain, he is panicked. You can see it in his eyes. And when he is recovering, he is restless. Uncertainty about his own state of health makes him less inclined for the expense and trouble of organizing a large tournament. When he does run a course with his experience, his weight and height, his superb horses and the steel of his temperament, he is likely to win. But to avoid accidents, he prefers to run against opponents he knows. Henry says,
"The Emperor, 2 or 3 years back when he was in Germany, did he not have an evil humour in his thigh? They say the weather didn't suit him, but then his dominions offer a change of climate, whereas from one part of my kingdom to the next there is no change to be found. Oh, I expect it's worse in Dublin."
Henry looks out, hopeless at the teeming rain.
"And when I ride out, the people shout at me. They rise up out of ditches and shout about Catherine, how I should take her back. How would they like if I told them how to order their houses and wives and children?"
Even when the weather clears, the king's fears do not diminish.
"She will escape and raise an army against me," he says. "Catherine, you do not know what she would do. She told me she would not run. And you think she never lies? I know she lies. I have proof of it. She lied about her own virginity." "Oh, that," he thinks tiredly. It seems Henry doesn't believe in the power of armed guards in locks and keys. He thinks an angel recruited by the Emperor Charles will make them fall away. When he travels, he takes with him a great iron lock, which is affixed to his chamber door by a servant who goes with him for the purpose. His food is tasted for poison, and his bed examined, last thing at night, for concealed weapons such as needles. But even so, he is afraid he will be murdered as he sleeps. Autumn. Thomas More is losing weight, a wiry little man emerging from what was never a superfluity of flesh. He lets Antonia Bonvisi send him food in. "Not that you Lucchese know how to eat. I'll send it myself. But if he took ill, you know what people would say. He likes dishes of eggs. I don't know if he likes much else."
A sigh.
"A milk puddings?"
He smiles.
"These are carnivorous days. No wonder he doesn't thrive."
"I have known him for 40 years, Bonvisi says. "A lifetime, Tommaso. You wouldn't hurt him, would you? Please assure me, if you can, that no one will hurt him."
"Why do you think I'm no better than he is? Look, I have no need to put him under pressure. His family and friends will do it, won't they?"
"Can't you just leave him there, forget him?"
"Of course, if the king allows."
He arranges for Meg Roper to visit. Father and daughter walk in the gardens arm in arm. Sometimes he watches them from a window in the Lord Lieutenant's lodgings. By November, this policy has failed. Turned back, really, and bitten his hand, like a dog that out of kindness you pick up in the street. Meg says,
"He has told me, and he has asked me to tell his friends, that he will have no more to do with oaths of any kind, and that if we hear he has sworn, we are to take it that he has been forced by ill usage and rough handling. And if a paper is shown to the council, with his signature on it, we are to understand it is not his hand."
More is now required to swear to the Act of Supremacy, an act which draws together all the powers and dignities assumed by the king in the last 2 years. It doesn't, as some say, make the king head of the church. It states that he is head of the church and always has been. If people don't like new ideas Let them have old ones. If they want precedence, he has precedence. A second enactment, which will come into force in the new year, defines the scope of treason. It will be a treasonable offence to deny Henry's titles or jurisdiction, to speak or write maliciously against him, to call him a heretic or a schismatic. This law will catch the friars who spread panic and say the Spanish are landing with the next tide to seize the throne for the Lady Mary. It will catch the priests who in their sermons rant against the king's authority and say he is dragging his subjects after him to hell. Is it much for a monarch to ask that a subject keep a civil tongue in his head? This is new, people say to him, this treason by words. And he says, no, be assured, it is old. It casts into statute law what the judges in their wisdom have already defined as common law. It is a measure for clarification. I am all for clarity. Upon More's refusal of this second oath, a bill is brought in against him, forfeiting his goods to the crown. He now has no hope of release, or rather the hope lies in himself. It is his duty to visit him, tell him he will no longer be allowed visitors or strolls in the garden. Nothing to see this time of year. More casts a glance at the sky, a narrow strip of grey through the high window. I can still have my books, write letters. For now. And John Wood, he stays with me. His servant. Yes, of course. He brings me a little news from time to time. They say the sweating sickness has broken out among the king's troops in Ireland, so late in the year, too. Plague has also broken out. He's not going to tell More that, or that the whole Irish campaign is a debacle, and a money sink, and that he wishes he'd done as Richard said and gone out there himself. The sweat takes off so many, More says, and so swiftly, and in their prime, too. And if you survive it, you are in no condition to fight the wild Irish, that's for sure. I remember when Meg took it, she nearly died. Have you had it? No. You're never ill, are you? He is chattering pointlessly, then he looks up. Tell me, what do you hear from Antwerp? They say Tyndale is there. They say he lives straitly. He dare not stray beyond the English merchant's house. They say he is in prison, almost as I am. It is true, or partly true. Tyndale has laboured in poverty and obscurity, and now his world has shrunk to a little room, while outside in the city, under the Emperor's laws, printers are branded and have their eyes put out, and brothers and sisters are killed for their faith, the men beheaded, the women buried alive. More has a sticky web in Europe still, a web made of money. It is his belief that his men have followed Tyndale these many months, but all his ingenuity, and Stephen Vaughan's on the spot, have not been able to find out which of the Englishmen who pass through that busy town are More's agents. Tyndale will be safer in London, More says, under yourself, the protector of error. Now, look at Germany today. You see, Thomas, where heresy leads us. It leads us to Munster, does it not?
This ends Disc 19.